Chapter 23 The Burning Wheel. I stayed tucked into my secret place all that night, and woke late the next day to find my body had stiffened into a tight knot of pain. Since I still had food and a little wine, I stayed where I was rather than risk falling when I tried to climb down to the street. It was a sunless day with a damp wind that never seemed to stop. Sleet gusted under the protection of the overhanging roof. The chimney was warm behind me, but it wasn't enough to actually dry out my blanket or drive away the chilly damp that soaked my clothes. I finished the wine and the bread early on, and after that I spent most of my time gnawing at the turkey bones and trying to warm up snow in the empty wine flask so I could drink it. Neither proved very productive, and I ended up eating mouthfuls of slushy snow that left me shivering with the taste of tar in my mouth. Despite my injuries, I dropped off to sleep in the afternoon and woke late at night filled with the most wonderful warmth. I pushed away my blanket and rolled away from the now too hot chimney, only to wake near dawn, shivering and soaked through to the skin. I felt strange, dizzy, and fuddled. I huddled back against the chimney and spent the rest of the day drifting in and out of a restless, fevered sleep. I have no memory of how I made it off the rooftop, delirious with fever and nearly crippled. I don't remember making my way the 3/4 of a mile through tallows and the crates. I only remember falling down the stairs that led to Trappis's basement, my purse of money clutched tight in my hand. As I lay there shivering and sweating, I heard the faint slapping of his bare feet on the stone.
What?
He said gently as he picked me up.
Hush, hush.
Trappis nursed me through the long days of my fever. He wrapped me in blankets, fed me, and when my fever showed no signs of breaking on its own, he used the money I'd brought to buy a bittersweet medicine. He kept my face and hands wet and cool while murmuring his patient, gentle,
What? Hush, hush.
While I cried out from endless fever dreams of my dead parents, the Chandrian, and a man with empty eyes. I woke clear-headed and cool. Tanny said loudly from where he was tied to his cot.
What? Hush, hush, Tanny, Trappis said as he put down one of the babies and picked up the other.
It looked around owlishly with wide, dark eyes, but seemed unable to support its own head. It was quiet in the room. Tanny said again. I coughed, trying to clear my throat.
There's a cub on the floor next to you,
Trappis said, brushing a hand along the head of the baby he held. Tanny bellowed, strange half-gasps punctuating his cry. The noise agitated several of the others, who moved restlessly in their cots. The older boy, sitting in the corner, raised his hands to the sides of his head and began to moan. He started rocking back and forth, gently at first, but then more and more violently, so that when he came forward, his head knocked against the bare stone of the wall. Trappis was at his side before the boy could do himself any real harm. He put his arms around the rocking boy.
Hush, hush, Lonnie, hush, hush.
The boy's rocking slowed, but did not entirely subside.
Tanny, you know better than to make all that noise.
His voice was serious, but not stern.
Why are you making trouble? Lonnie could hurt himself.
Tanny said softly. I thought I could detect a note of remorse in his voice.
I think he wants a story,
I said, surprising myself by speaking.
Ah,
Tanny said.
Is that what you want, Tanny?
There was a quiet moment.
I don't know any stories, he said. Tani remained stubbornly silent. Everyone knows one story, I thought. Everyone knows at least one. Trappist looked around at the quiet room, as if looking for an excuse.
Well, he said reluctantly, it has been a while since we had a story, hasn't it?
He looked down at the boy in his arms.
Would you like a story, Loni?
Loni nodded a violent affirmation, nearly battering Trappist's cheek with the back of his head.
Will you be good and sit by yourself so I can tell a story?
Loni stopped rocking almost immediately. Trappist slowly unwrapped his arms and stepped away. After a long look to make sure the boy wouldn't hurt himself, he stepped carefully back to his chair.
Well,
he muttered softly to himself as he stooped to pick up the baby he had set aside.
Do I have a story?
He spoke very quietly to the child's wide eyes.
No. No, I don't. Can I remember one? I suppose I had better.
He sat for a long moment, humming to the child in his arms, a thoughtful expression on his face.
Yes, of course.
He sat up taller in his chair.
Are you ready? This is a story from long ago, back before any of us were born, before our fathers were born, too. It was a long time ago, maybe 400 years, no more than that, probably 1,000 years, but maybe not quite as much as that. It was a bad time in the world. People were hungry and sick. There were famines and great plagues. There were many wars and other bad things in this time, because there was no one to stop them. But the worst thing in this time was that there were demons walking the land. Some of them were small and troublesome creatures who lamed horses and spoiled milk, but there were many worse than those. There were demons who hid in men's bodies and made them sick or mad. Those were not the worst. There were demons like great beasts that would catch and eat men while they were still alive and screaming. But they were not the worst. Some demons stole the skins of men and wore them like clothes, but even they were not the worst. There was one demon who stood above the others. Encarnis, the swallowing darkness. No matter where he walked, shadows hid his face, and scorpions that stung him died of the corruption they had touched. Now Telu, who made the world, and who is lord over all, watched the world of men. He saw that demons made sport of us, and killed us, and ate our bodies. Some men he saved, but only a few. For Telu is just and saves only the worthy. And in these times few men acted even for their own good, let alone the good of others. Because of this, Telu was unhappy, for he had made the world to be a good place for men to live. But his church was corrupt. They stole from the poor and did not live by the laws he had given. No, wait. There was no church yet, and no priests either, just men and women, and some of them knew who Telu was. But even those were wicked, so when they called on Lord Telu for help, he felt no desire to aid them. But after years of watching and waiting, Telu saw a woman pure of heart and spirit. Her name was Periel. Her mother had raised her to know Telu, and she worshipped him as well as her poor circumstances allowed. Although her own life was hard, Periel prayed only for others, and never for herself. Telu watched her for long years. He saw her life was hard, full of misfortune and torment at the hands of demons and bad men. But she never cursed his name, or ceased her praying, and she never treated any person other than with kindness and respect. So, late one night, Tailu went to her in a dream. He stood before her, and seemed to be made entirely of fire or sunlight. He came to her in splendor and asked her if she knew who he was. Sure enough, she said. You see, she was very calm about it because she thought she was just having an odd dream. Your Lord Tailu. He nodded and asked her if she knew why he had come to her. Are you going to do something for my neighbour, Deborah? She asked, because that's who she had prayed for before she went to sleep. Are you going to lay your hand on her husband, Lozel, and make him a better man? The way he treats her isn't right. Man should never lay a hand on woman, save in love. Tailu knew her neighbours. He knew they were wicked people who had done wicked things. Everyone in the village was wicked but her. Everyone in the world was. He told her so. Deborah has been very kind and good to me, Periel said, and even Lozel, who I don't care for, is one of my neighbours all the same. Tailu told her that Deborah spent time in many different men's beds, and Lozel drank every day of the week, even on morning. No, wait, there wasn't any morning yet, but he drank a lot at any rate. Sometimes he grew so angry that he beat his wife until she could not stand or even cry aloud. Periel was quiet for a long moment in her dream. She knew Tailu spoke the truth, but while Periel was pure of heart, she was not a fool. She had suspected her neighbours of doing the things Tailu said. Even now that she knew for certain, she cared for her neighbours all the same. You want help her? Tailu said that the man and wife were each other's fitting punishment. They were wicked, and the wicked should be punished. Periel spoke out honestly, perhaps because she thought she was dreaming, but perhaps she would have said the same thing had she been awake. But Periel said what was in her heart. It's not their fault that the world is full of hard choices and hunger and loneliness, she said. What can you expect of people when demons are their neighbours? But though Tailu listened to her wise words with his ears, he told her that mankind was wicked, and the wicked should be punished. I think you know very little about what it is to be a man, she said, and I would still help them if I could, she told him resolutely. So you shall, Tailu told her, and reached out to lay his hand on her heart. When he touched her, she felt like she were a great golden bell that had just rung out its first note. She opened her eyes and knew then that it had been no normal dream. Thus it was that she was not surprised to discover she was pregnant. In 3 months, she gave birth to a perfect dark-eyed baby boy. She named him Menda. The day after he was born, Menda could crawl. In 2 days, he could walk. Periel was surprised but not worried, for she knew the child was a gift from God. Nevertheless, Periel was wise. She knew that people might not understand, so she kept Menda close by her, and when her friends and neighbours came to visit, she sent them away. But this could only last a little while, for in a small town there are no secrets. Folk knew that Periel was not married, and while children born out of wedlock were common during this time, children who grew to manhood in less than 2 months were not. They were afraid that she might have lain down with a demon, and that her child was a demon's child. Such things were not unheard of in those dark times, and the people were afraid. So everyone gathered together on the first day of the seventh span and made their way to the tiny house where Periel lived by herself with her son. The town smith, whose name was Rengen, led them. "Show us the boy," he yelled. But there was no response from the house. "Bring out the boy and show us he is nothing but a human child." The house remained quiet, and though there were many men among them, no one wanted to enter a house that might have a demon's child inside. So the smith cried out again, "Periel, bring out young Mender, or we will burn your house around you." The door opened, and a man stepped out. None of them recognized who it was, because even though he was only 7 span from the womb, Mender looked to be a young man of 17. He stood proud and tall, with coal black hair and eyes. "I am the one you think is Mender," he said in a voice both powerful and deep. "What do you want of me?" The sound of his voice made Periel gasp inside the cottage. Not only was this the first time Mender had ever spoken, but she recognized his voice as the same one that had spoken to her in a dream months ago. "What do you mean, we think you are Mender?" asked the smith, gripping his hammer tightly. He knew that there were demons that looked like men, or wore their skins like costumes, the way a man might hide beneath a sheepskin. The child who was not a child spoke again. "I am Periel's son, but I am not Mender, and I am not a demon." "Touch the iron of my hammer, then," said Rengen, for he knew all demons feared 2 things, cold iron and clean fire. He held out his heavy forge hammer. It shook in his hands, but no one thought the less of him for it. He who was not Mender stepped forward and lay both hands on the iron head of the hammer. Nothing happened. From the doorway of her house where she watched, Periel burst into tears, for though she trusted Teilu, some part of her had held a mother's worry for her son. "I am not Mender, though that is what my mother called me. I am Teilu, lord above all. I have come to free you from demons and the wickedness of your own hearts. I am Teilu, son of myself. Let the wicked hear my voice and tremble." And they did tremble. But some of them refused to believe. They called him a demon and threatened him. They spoke hard, frightened words. Some threw stones and cursed him and spat toward him and his mother. Then Teilu grew angry, and he might have slain them all. But Periel leaped forward and laid a restraining hand on his shoulder. "What more can you expect," she asked him quietly, "from men who live with demons for their neighbours? Even the best dog will bite that has been kicked enough." Teilu considered her words and saw that she was wise. So he looked over his hands at Rengen, looked deep into his heart and said, "Rengen, son of Engen, you have a mistress who you pay to lie with you. Some men come to you for work, and you cheat or steal from them. And though you pray loudly, you do not believe. I, Teilu, made the world and watch over all who live here." When Rengen heard this, he grew pale and dropped his hammer to the ground. For what Teilu said to him was true. Teilu looked at all the men and women there. He looked into their hearts and spoke of what he saw. All of them were wicked, so much that Rengen was among the best of them. Then Teilu drew a line in the dirt of the road, so that it lay between himself and all those who had come. "This road is like the meandering course of a life. There are 2 paths to take side by side. Each of you are already travelling that side. You must choose. Stay on your own path, or cross to mine." "But the road is the same, isn't it? It still goes to the same place," someone asked. "Yes. Where does the road lead?" "Death. All lives end in death, excepting one. Such is the way of things." "And what does it matter which side a man is on?" It was Rengen asking these questions. He was a large man, one of the few that was taller than dark-eyed Teilu. But he was shaken by all that he had seen and heard in the past few hours. "What is on our side of the road?" "Pain," Teilu said in a voice as hard and cold as stone. Punishment! And your side? Pain now, Teilu said in the same voice. Punishment now for all that you have done. It cannot be avoided. But I am here too. This is my path. How do I cross? Regret, repent, and cross to me. Rengen stepped over the line to stand beside his god. Then Teilu bent to pick up the hammer that the smith had dropped. But instead of giving it back, he struck Rengen with it as if it were a lash. Once, twice, thrice, and the third blow sent Rengen to his knees, sobbing and crying out in pain. But after the third blow, Teilu laid the hammer aside and knelt to look Rengen in the face. You were the first to cross, he said softly, so only the smith could hear. It was a brave thing, a hard thing to do. I am proud of you. You are no longer Rengen. Now you are Wereth, the forger of the path. Then Teilu embraced him with both arms, and his touch took much of the pain from Rengen, who was now Wereth. But not all, for Teilu spoke truly when he said that punishment cannot be avoided. One by one they crossed, and one by one Teilu struck them down with the hammer. But after each man or woman fell, Teilu knelt and spoke to them, giving them new names and healing some of their hurt. Many of the men and women had demons hiding inside them that fled screaming when the hammer touched them. These people Teilu spoke with a while longer, but he always embraced them in the end, and they were all grateful. Some of them danced for the joy of being free of such terrible things living inside them. In the end, seven stayed on the other side of the line. Teilu asked them three times if they would cross, and three times they refused. After the third asking, Teilu sprang across the line, and he struck each of them a great blow, driving them to the ground. But not all were men. When Teilu struck the fourth, there was the sound of quenching iron and the smell of burning leather, for the fourth man had not been a man at all, but a demon wearing a man's skin. When it was revealed, Teilu grabbed the demon and broke it in his hands, cursing its name and sending it back to the outer darkness that is the home of its kind. The remaining three let themselves be struck down. None of them were demons, though demons fled the bodies of some who fell. After he was done, Teilu did not speak to the six who did not cross, nor did he kneel to embrace them and ease their wounds. The next day, Teilu set off to finish what he had begun. He walked from town to town, offering each village he met the same choice he had given before. Always the results were the same. Some crossed, some stayed, some were not men at all, but demons and those he destroyed. But there was one demon who eluded Teilu. Incanis, whose face was all in shadow. Incanis, whose voice was like a knife in the minds of men. Wherever Teilu stopped to offer men the choice of path, Incanis had been there just before, killing crops and poisoning wells. Incanis setting men to murder one another and stealing children from their beds at night. At the end of 7 years, Teilu's feet had carried him all through the world. He had driven out the demons that plagued us, all but one. Incanis ran free and did the work of 1,000 demons, destroying and despoiling wherever he went. So Teilu chased, and Incanis fled. Soon Teilu was a span of days behind the demon, then 2 days, then half a day. Finally he was so close, he felt the chill of Incanis's passing and could spy places where he had set his hands and feet, for they were marked with a cold, black frost. Knowing he was pursued, Encarnis came to a great city. The Lord of Demons called forth his power, and the city was brought to ruin. He did this, hoping Taelu would delay so he could make his escape, but the Walking God paused only to appoint priests who cared for the people of the ruined town. For 6 days, Encarnis fled, and 6 great cities he destroyed. But on the 7th day, Taelu drew near before Encarnis could bring his power to bear, and the 7th city was saved. That is why 7 is a lucky number, and why we celebrate on Canaan. Encarnis was now hard-pressed, and bent his whole thought upon escape. But on the 8th day, Taelu did not pause to sleep or eat, and thus it was that at the end of felling, Taelu caught Encarnis. He leaped on the demon and struck him with his forge hammer. Encarnis fell like a stone, but Taelu's hammer shattered and lay in the dust of the road. Taelu carried the demon's limp body all through the long night, and on the morning of the 9th day he came to the city of Artur. When men saw Taelu carrying the demon's senseless form, they thought Encarnis dead. But Taelu knew that such a thing was not easily done. No simple blade or blow could kill him. No cell of bars could keep him safe within. So Taelu carried Encarnis to the smithy. He called for iron, and people brought all they owned. Though he had taken no rest, nor a morsel of food, all through the 9th day, Taelu labored. While 10 men worked the bellows, Taelu forged the great iron wheel. All night he worked, and when the first light of the 10th morning touched him, Taelu struck the wheel 1 final time, and it was finished. Wrought all of black iron, the wheel stood taller than a man. It had 6 spokes, each thicker than a hammer's haft, and its rim was a handspan across. It weighed as much as 40 men, and was cold to the touch. The sound of its name was terrible, and none could speak it. Taelu gathered the people who were watching, and chose a priest among them. Then he set them to dig a great pit in the center of the town, 15 feet wide and 20 feet deep. With the sun rising, Taelu laid the body of the demon on the wheel. At the first touch of iron, Encarnis began to stir in his sleep. But Taelu chained him tightly to the wheel, hammering the links together, sealing them tighter than any lock. Then Taelu stepped back, and all saw Encarnis shift again, as if disturbed by an unpleasant dream. Then he shook and came awake entirely. Encarnis strained against the chains, his body arching upward as he pulled against them. Where the iron touched his skin, it felt like knives and needles and nails, like the searing pain of frost, like the sting of 100 biting flies. Encarnis thrashed on the wheel and began to howl as the iron burned and bit and froze him. To Taelu, the sound was like a sweet music. He lay down on the ground beside the wheel and slept a deep sleep, for he was very tired. When he awoke, it was evening of the 10th day. Encarnis was still bound to the wheel, but he no longer howled and fought like a trapped animal. Taelu bent, and with great effort lifted one edge of the wheel and set it leaning against a tree that grew nearby. As soon as he came close, Encarnis cursed him in languages no one knew, scratching and biting. "You brought this on yourself," Taelu said. At night, there was a celebration. Telu sent men to cut a dozen evergreens and use them to kindle a bonfire in the bottom of the deep pit they had dug. All night the townsfolk danced and sang around the burning fire. They knew the last and most dangerous of the world's demons was finally caught. And all night Encarnis hung from his wheel and watched them, motionless as a snake. When the morning of the 11th day came, Telu went to Encarnis a third and final time. The demon looked worn and feral. His skin was sallow, and his bones pressed tight against his skin. But his power still lay around him like a dark mantle, hiding his face in shadow. Encarnis, Telu said, this is your last chance to speak. Do it, for I know it is within your power. Lord Telu, I am not Encarnis. For that brief moment, the demon's voice was pitiful, and all who heard it were moved to sorrow. But then there was a sound like quenching iron, and the wheel rung like an iron bell. Encarnis's body arched painfully at the sound, then hung limply from his wrists as the ringing of the wheel faded. Try no tricks, Dark One. Speak no lies, Telu said sternly, his eyes as dark and hard as the iron of the wheel. What then? Encarnis hissed, his voice like the rasp of stone on stone. What? Rack and shatter you? What do you want of me? Your road is very short, Encarnis, but you may still choose a side on which to travel. Encarnis laughed. Ha ha! You will give me the same choice you gave the cattle? Yes, then I will cross to your side of the path. I regret and rep. The wheel rung again, like a great bell tolling long and deep. Encarnis threw his body against the chains again, and the sound of his scream shook the earth and shattered stones for half a mile in each direction. When the sounds of wheel and scream had faded, Encarnis hung panting and shaking from his chains. I told you to speak no lie, Encarnis, Telu said, pitiless. My path, then, Encarnis shrieked, I do not regret. If I had my choice again, I would only change how fast I ran. Your people are like cattle my kind feed on. Bite and break. You, if you gave me half an hour, I would do such things that these wretched, gawping peasants would go mad with fear. I would drink their children's blood and bathe in women's tears. He might have said more, but his breath was short as he strained against the chains that held him. So, Telu said, and stepped close to the wheel. For a moment it seemed like he would embrace Encarnis, but he was merely reaching for the iron spokes of the wheel. Then, straining, Telu lifted the wheel above his head. He carried it, arms upstretched towards the pit, and threw Encarnis in. Through the long hours of night, a dozen evergreens had fed the fire. The flames had died in the early morning, leaving a deep bed of sullen coals that glimmered when the wind brushed them. The wheel struck flat with Encarnis on top. There was an explosion of spark and ash as it landed and sank inches deep into the hot coals. Encarnis was held over the coals by the iron that bound and burned and bit at him. Though he was held away from the fire itself, the heat was so intense that Encarnis's clothes charred black and began to crumble without bursting into flame. The demon thrashed against his bonds, settling the wheel more firmly into the coals. Encarnis screamed because he knew that even demons can die from fire or iron. And though he was powerful, he was bound and burning. He felt the metal of the wheel grow hot beneath him, blackening the flesh of his arms and legs. Encarni screamed, and even as his skin began to smoke and char, his face was still hidden in a shadow that rose from him like a tongue of darkening flame. Then Encarni's grew silent, and the only sound was the hiss of sweat and blood as they fell from the demon's straining limbs. For a long moment, everything was still. Encarnis strained against the chains that held him to the wheel, and it seemed that he would strain until his muscles tore themselves from bone and sinew both. Then there was a sharp sound, like a bell breaking, and the demon's arm jerked free of the wheel. Links of chain, now glowing red from the heat of the fire, flew upward to land, smoking at the feet of those who stood above. The only sound was the sudden, wild laughter of Encarnis, like breaking glass. In a moment, the demon's second hand was free. But before he could do more, Teilu flung himself into the pit and landed with such force that the iron rang with it. Teilu grabbed the hands of the demon and pressed them back against the wheel. Encarni screamed in fury and in disbelief, for though he was forced back onto the burning wheel, and though he felt the strength of Teilu was greater than chains he had broken, he saw Teilu was burning in the flames. "Fool," he wailed, "you will die here with me. Let me go and live. Let me go and I will trouble you no further." And the wheel did not ring out, for Encarnis was truly frightened. "No," said Teilu, "your punishment is death. You will serve it." "Fool, madling," Encarnis thrashed to no avail. "You are burning in the flames with me. You will die as I do." "To ash all things return, so too this flesh will burn. But I am Teilu, son of myself, father of myself. I was before and I will be after. If I am a sacrifice, then it is to myself alone, and if I am needed and called in the proper ways, then I will come again to judge and punish." So Teilu held him to the burning wheel, and none of the demon's threats or screaming moved him the least part of an inch. So it was that Encarnis passed from the world, and with him went Teilu, who was Menda. Both of them burned to ash in the pit in Atur. That is why the Telin priests wear robes of ashen grey. And that is how we know Teilu cares for us, and watches us, and keeps us safe from...
Trappist broke off his story, as Jaspin began to howl and thrash against his restraints. I slid softly back into unconsciousness as soon as I no longer had the story to hold my attention. After that, I began to harbor a suspicion that never entirely left me. Was Trappist a Talin priest? His robe was tattered and dirty, but it might have been the proper grey long ago. Parts of his story had been awkward and stumbling, but some were stately and grand, as if he had been reciting them from some half-forgotten memory. Of sermons, of his readings from the Book of the Path. I never asked. And though I stopped by his basement frequently in the months that followed, I never heard Trappist tell another story again.